At least 25 people have been killed and several others injured in an airstrike on a house in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Several areas in Gaza City, as well as Beit Lahia and Rafah, also witnessed fresh Israeli attacks. The airstrikes and artillery fire on Gaza are coupled with a ground invasion. The regime's military says its troops have begun operating the Shuja'iyya area in the northern Gaza Strip. The genocidal war on Gaza continues amid the dire situation of health facilities there. The director of the Baptist Hospital says the situation is catastrophic and out of control. Since October 2023, over 50,600 Palestinians have been killed in the genocidal war. Well, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has strongly condemned Israel's deadly attacks on the World Body's facilities in Gaza. The UNRWA chief called the regime's attacks a violation of international law, demanding an independent investigation into them. Philippe Lazzarini made the remarks while slamming Israel's targeting of an UNRWA building in northern Gaza, which killed 9 children. He said since October 2023, more than 300 UN buildings have been damaged or destroyed by Israel, and over 700 people have been killed while seeking UN protection. Lazzarini's remarks came as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights slammed Israel's March 23rd attack on a number of ambulances, killing 15 medics and humanitarian workers. Addressing the UN Security Council, Volker Turk said the appalling attack raises concerns over the commission of war crimes by Israel. He also condemned Israel's ban on the entry of humanitarian aid to Gaza for a month. Turk said the blockade of Gaza constitutes a form of collective punishment and may also amount to the use of starvation as a method of war. We were earlier joined by political analyst Samuel Geddes from Melbourne. He gave us his insight on what the international community can do to rein in Israel as it continues with its genocidal war on Gaza.
Well, I certainly wouldn't expect the organs of the UN to take any meaningful action, especially not the Security Council. I think it really falls to individual states around the world acting on their own and collectively with others. We have seen this, the beginnings of this, I think, being led by the Malaysian government, enforcing their own multilateral or unilateral sanctions against Israel. So effectively globalizing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which has absolutely moved into the mainstream in the last year and a half, and there is no way that that is going to be reversed. So really, I would imagine the most effective action in the hands of people around the world, and especially governments, is to enact sanctions, financial, military, political sanctions. That would seem to be the tactic that would have the greatest chance of actually producing results in reining in Israeli and American behavior.
Well, now joining us for the latest from Gaza is our correspondent Muti Abu Musabih there from Deir al-Balah. Muti, I'm not going to be asking you about the updates there in Gaza. Yesterday, I actually witnessed all over social media, specifically X, Palestinians in Gaza actually writing down their final farewells to the world as the slaughtering of Gazans do continue there. Muti, if you were to tell the world something, to tell the world that Gazans are not simply just a number, that they are human beings being massacred, being genocided by the Israeli entity, what would you have to say, Muti?
Yes, I would like to say that all hell broke loose for the Palestinian people here in Gaza Strip over the past 24 hours after the Israeli occupation forces intensified and expedited the genocide and brutal attacks against the Palestinian people. Several horrific and brutal massacres have been committed against the Palestinian people, particularly in Jabal al-Fashi camp after the Israeli occupation forces in Gaza City, after the Israeli warplanes targeted and destroyed as you know, Al-Arqam school, which was taken shelter by thousands of the Palestinian displaced people. We're talking about at least 35 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, have been slaughtered in that massacre. In the meantime, 40 Palestinian civilians are still presumed missing under the debris and rubble of the destroyed buildings there, and several dead bodies were vanished, unfortunately revealing how brutal and horrific that attack was against the Palestinian people. The current situation is extremely horrific and unbearable for the Palestinian people. In the meantime, several massacres were also committed against the Palestinian people in the southern parts of Gaza Strip, like what happened over the last night after the Israeli warplanes pounded and destroyed a multi-floor residential building in Abassan town in the eastern part of Khan Yunis city, killing at least 25 Palestinian civilians of Al-Aqad family there. And we are talking about more, as you know, brutal and deadly Israeli strikes and attacks are still carried out against the Palestinian people. The Israeli shelling and bombardments are still ongoing and ceaseless elsewhere in Gaza Strip. All elsewhere in Gaza Strip is still witnessing more cruel and brutal attacks, claiming more lives of the Palestinian people. And on the ground, the Israeli occupation force also intensified the artillery shelling, targeting different parts of Gaza Strip, particularly in the eastern section of Gaza Strip and the areas adjacent to the eastern borders of Gaza Strip, like the Ash-Shajaiya neighborhood, which is still witnessing more cruel and intense artillery shelling targeting the Palestinian people, whereas four Palestinian civilians at least were confirmed killed as a result of that intense artillery shelling in Ash-Shajaiya neighborhood. Needless to mention that the Israeli army announced that they are going to, as you know, proceed to carry out another ground offensive against Ash-Shajaiya neighborhood. This is why they are still targeting that area extensively with the artillery shelling and the gunfire maintained by the Israeli occupation forces. Even when it comes to Rafah City, as you know, Rafah City for more than four consecutive days has been under the extensive and non-stop Israeli air strikes and attacks and the artillery shelling, in addition to the ongoing ground offensive that targets the entire city. The current situation there is extremely horrific and horrible for the Palestinian people. Generally speaking, we can say that more than 30% of Gaza's areas are under the control of the Israeli occupation forces, and they are still expanding the genocide, the ground offensive targeting the Palestinian people. They are still vowing to carry out more ground attacks targeting the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip. And this is why the Palestinian people are still petrified with these, as you know, horrific measures and attacks carried out by the Israeli occupation forces, particularly regarding, as you know, the new tactics embraced by the Israeli occupation forces regarding cutting off, as you know, the Gaza districts and governorates from each other, like what happened in Rafah after the Israeli occupation forces took control over Mirage Corridor. This means clearly that Rafah City is completely separated from the entire areas of Gaza Strip, and this could be, as you know, reiterated and carried out once again in different parts of Gaza Strip, like, as you know, we are talking about Netzarim Corridor, we are talking about Miflasim Corridor, which is located in the northern part of Gaza Strip.
Muti Abu Musabah, our correspondent there, joining us from Deir al-Balah. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. The military wing of Hamas has confirmed the killing of one of its commanders in an Israeli airstrike on the Lebanese city of Sidon or Saida. The Qassam Brigade hails Hassan Farhat for his prominent role in the resistance against Israel. The military wing of Hamas underlined that Israel's cowardly assassinations against Palestinian resistance fighters will never stop them from continuing on the path of perseverance and sacrifice for their sacred goal. In a separate statement, Lebanon's prime minister condemned the attack as a blatant assault on Lebanon's sovereignty. Nawaf Salam said Israel once again targeted peaceful civilians, calling for maximum pressure on the regime to end its aggression against Lebanon. Apart from Hassan Farhat himself, the Israeli airstrike on Sidon or Saida took the lives of his daughter and son. Israel has repeatedly violated the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon that came into effect in late November of last year. Now joining us live from Beirut is our correspondent, Maryam Saleh. Maryam, this is definitely another attack while people are sleeping, early hours of the morning, another assassination, and another large major, as we remind the city, basically, Saida there in Lebanon. And again, Nawaf Salam, the president there, are adding more condemnations. No actions have been taken. What's the situation? What latest developments do you have for us, Maryam?
in South Lebanon. Now you have the second strike in a row, which is directly targeting a residential neighborhood and a building where there are civilians. We saw that previously the Israelis targeted a building in the southern suburbs of Beirut, and so this is in the heart of the capital of Lebanon, killing not only a Hezbollah commander, but along with him, his son, and two other civilians in a separate apartment. Today also, we have another attack against this building where this Hamas official was assassinated along with his son and daughter. And so the Israelis are not only violating 1701, the United Nations resolutions, they're violating the ceasefire, but they're also violating all international law and charters that specifically say that even any military personnel that is in their civilian atmosphere, within their family, they should not be targeted because of the fact that there will be collateral damage, there will be civilians that will be killed as a result of that attack. And so Israel seems to completely disregard any type of international resolutions. This is what we're looking at. We've seen it in the war, throughout the times of war, where the Israelis had actually targeted civilians, killing more than 20 people in a row in one strike, only to target one person, and at many times that person was not there. And so the only victims of those attacks were civilians. The Israelis were actually using this as a pretext, saying that they have the right to target, or that this personality or this official in Hamas or Hezbollah is working on attacks against the Israeli regime. And so this is their, of course, their continuous sort of narrative. Now, when it comes to the Lebanese officials, we also have the same statements of denouncement. We also saw that Speaker Nabih Berri clearly said this is not just only denouncing, this is also showing the world the extent of brutality that the Israeli regime is practicing against Lebanon, as they are practicing it against Gaza. And well, and all this comes at a time when there is mounted pressure against Lebanon from the United States, from the deputy envoy to the Middle East, Morgan Ortegas, who is expected to arrive into Lebanon and to put more conditions on the Lebanese government. Now, we know from the Lebanese government, from sources close to the president and the prime minister and speaker of the parliament, that there will be a united a stance from the officials in Lebanon, stressing that they will not accept to go for direct negotiations with the Israeli regime as long as there is occupation of Lebanon, as long as the Israelis continue with their aggression, and as long as there is no comprehensive peace in the entire region in the Middle East, and there is continuous, of course, occupation of Palestine and an aggression against Gaza and the West Bank. And so we have that stance, which is very important. We don't know how far the Lebanese government will go in really resisting the U.S. Pressure on the government, in addition to the fact that there are also other sources that are stressing that there could also be more blackmail from the U.S., saying that there will not be assistance, or they will not even allow assistance for the rebuilding process of Lebanon as a result of the Israeli aggression until Lebanon abides by the U.S. dictates and the Israeli dictates, which is, as they are saying, complete disarmament of the resistance in Lebanon, in addition to going for direct negotiations. And as you know, based on Lebanese law, the Israeli regime is an enemy of the state of Lebanon, and the Lebanese government does not allow any sort of direct negotiations or direct contact with the Israeli terrorist regime until, they say, of course, there is comprehensive peace in the entire region.
Exactly.
And there's a liberation.
Well, Mariam, I am
going
to have
Palestine.
To cut you off there. We are running a bit short on time. I'd like to thank you very much for those latest developments, and we'll definitely stay with you with the latest. There are Mariam Saleh, our correspondent from Beirut. The Israeli violence against Palestinians in the West Bank continues unabated. The regime's forces have killed two more Palestinians in the occupied territory. One of the victims, named Hussein Harudan, was shot dead during an Israeli raid in Jenin. In a separate incident, Israeli forces shot a Palestinian teenager near Bethlehem over alleged stone throwing at settler vehicles. The teenager was later pronounced dead as he had received critical injuries to his upper body. Israeli violence in the West Bank was not limited to deadly raids by the regime's troops. Reports say Israeli settlers attacked a village near Salfit. The settlers set a Palestinian-owned vehicle on fire and threw Molotov cocktails at homes filled with civilians. Violent raids by Israeli soldiers and settlers have significantly increased across the West Bank since the Gaza genocide began. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Naqat Hamad, joined us earlier to update us on the latest Israeli crimes in the occupied West Bank. Let's take a listen.
In the last 12 hours, two Palestinians have been announced killed by the IOF forces. One of them is a Palestinian child, 17 years old, Youssef Bakr Zaghloul, in Husan, to the south of Beit Lahem. Of course, the story beyond Youssef was actually terrifying when the Israeli military jeep ran Youssef over and precisely ran his head over, killing him intentionally in the area of Husan. The other Palestinian who was announced killed, Hussein Hardan, 40 years old, a freed prisoner and ex-wounded Palestinian, and he has been traced down by the Israeli forces for more than 3 years now. Yesterday, the Israeli forces were able to, unfortunately, shoot him, and then he was announced killed in the province of Jenin. And just yesterday, the Israeli outpost minister have given the Israeli settlers in the illegal outpost have given them vehicles to move and to wander freely between the Palestinian villages, and an act, of course, to show that the government and the Israeli regime is not far from what the Israeli settlers are doing.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On January 16, 1979, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the last Shah of Iran, fled the country, recognizing that he could not withstand the tumult of the Iranian Revolution. 2 weeks later, on February 1, Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini returned to Iran after years in exile, greeted by millions who viewed him as the leader of the revolution. By February 11, the monarchy was dismantled forever. In the wake of the monarchy's collapse, a system that had ruled Iran for millennia, several critical questions arose. Should the nation seek a new monarch, or was it time to establish a new form of governance? If a new system was necessary, what shape should it take? The last one was the pressing question of the moment. Five days after Imam Khomeini returned to Iran, he appointed Mr. Mehdi Bazargan as prime minister to form a provisional government. One of the key responsibilities of this government was to conduct a referendum for the establishment of the Islamic Republic system. Imam Khomeini remarked, "While I believe there is no longer a need for a referendum, as the people have repeatedly voted for the Islamic Republic in different ways, we must still undertake this task freely, to eliminate any excuses and ensure the votes are counted. This way, both the people and the entire world will know who the citizens are voting for and which political system they are supporting." Mr. Ali Asghar Shafiyan, the managing director of Insaf News, who also serves as a media consultant to Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian.
A revolution succeeded in Iran in 1979, leading to the establishment of a new system in the country. The fact that the people were asked about the type of government is a very rare occurrence, especially about 5 decades ago. Even today, if a government is overthrown, the people are not asked about the type of new government, let alone half a century ago. Therefore, the 1979 referendum is significant in itself as an event that rarely occurs after the victory of revolutions.
There were many debates regarding the shape and name of the newly established system. Despite the Imam's views and the public opinion that it should be the Islamic Republic, some groups initially held different opinions. For example, a group known as the Radical Movement called for the establishment of a republic. Some other groups, such as the Writers Association, the National Democratic Party of Iran, and Kurdish parties, advocated for a Democratic Republic of Iran. Meanwhile, some leftist groups demanded the establishment of a People's Republic or a Federative Republic of the Peoples of Iran. Meanwhile, Mr. Bazargan and some other figures of the provisional government supported the idea of an Islamic Democratic Republic. Imam Khomeini opposed this view, believing that Islam is not incompatible with democracy, so it is a redundant adjective. Gradually, almost all groups came to an agreement on the Islamic Republic, with the exception of a few leftists and some separatist parties, who did not vote for it and caused chaos on election day. Mr. Hamid Reza Taraqi, a senior member of the Islamic Coalition Party.
At a time when Imam Khomeini suggested holding a referendum for establishing an Islamic Republic, some people opposed it. They argued, why Islamic? It should just be a republic. Others asked, why not a democratic republic? Or how about a democratic Islamic Republic? Imam Khomeini responded that these additional descriptors were a way for those individuals to express their opposition to the essence of Islam. When over 98% of people voted for the Islamic Republic, it became clear that what Imam Khomeini emphasized, the Islamic Republic, was indeed the true desire of the people. It's also worth noting that the opponents of the Shah were diverse. They were communist and leftist struggling against the Shah, as well as eclectic groups, intellectuals, and nationalists. None of these groups succeeded in the fight against the Shah because they lacked popular support. When Imam Khomeini, as a religious scholar, began his struggle against the Shah's regime, the people rallied behind him. From the outset, he stated his intention to implement Islamic laws in society, and that was why the people supported him. Therefore, it's evident that the people were seeking a republic system based on Islamic laws, not on Western concepts.
On April 1st this year, the Iranian people celebrated the 46th anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Republic. This day marks the historic referendum of 1979, where Iranians overwhelmingly chose to break free from the monarchical rule just weeks after the fall of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. It was a resounding yes to the Islamic Republic of Iran, a pivotal moment in the history of this land. The Revolutionary Council designated March 13, 1979, as the official voting day for the referendum. In the early hours of that morning, the polling began with remarkable enthusiasm. For many citizens, it marked their first experience participating in a democratic process. As the day progressed, the high volume of voters and the depletion of ballots in some regions prompted Imam Khomeini to authorize a 24-hour extension for the voting. Mr. Mohammad Javad Akhavan, the editor-in-chief of Javan newspaper.
It is clear that any revolution achieves success through the participation of the people, and the same applies to the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Considering that the Pahlavi regime was heavily supported by the West, the revolution would not have succeeded without widespread public involvement. Therefore, there is no doubt that the Shah's regime was overthrown through a democratic process. However, Imam Khomeini insisted on holding a referendum to define the type of government based on the people's voices. While the revolution itself was a form of referendum, Imam Khomeini wanted the people's desire, specifically the rejection of the monarchical system and the establishment of the Islamic Republic, to be formally recorded in a transparent process. Yet the referendum was not the whole story. After the referendum, another election was held for people to choose representatives to review the draft constitution, leading to the formation of the Assembly of Experts for the Constitution, again through the people's vote. But even that was in the end. After the completion of the Constitution, Imam Khomeini stated that there should be elections for the people to approve or reject the Constitution with their votes. Later that same year, in 1979, two more elections, a parliamentary election and a presidential election, were held. In total, five elections took place in Iran within a year after the revolution, which is quite rare, if not unprecedented, worldwide.
In his memoirs, former Deputy Prime Minister of Iran for Public Relations, Sadiq Tabatabai, shares an account of the voting process involving some high-ranking officials of the Pahlavi regime while in prison. He notes, officials from the Ministry of Interior went to hospitals and prisons with mobile ballot boxes. Notably, Amir Abbas Hoveida, who was incarcerated, requested to vote, and upon receiving a ballot, he cast a yes vote for the Islamic Republic. By 1 a.m., the initial results were tabulated. While voting did not take place in certain cities and some areas did not receive ballots, statistical data indicated that approximately 94% of eligible voters participated in the referendum. The results of this referendum were announced by Ahmad Saad Haj Sayyid Javadi, the then Minister of Interior, revealing the following figures. Participants, 20,288,021. Positive votes, 20,147,055. Negative votes, 140,966. We posed the question to Mr. Taraki that has been circulating on social media for a while. Were people intimidated into voting for the Islamic Republic?
I was there at a time, and I clearly remember the process of holding the referendum. The referendum took place in a completely free atmosphere. The people had just emerged from the suffocating environment that the Shah's regime had created, and freedom was very significant to them. Everyone voted for the Islamic Republic with complete freedom, without any fear. Imam Khomeini did not attempt to impose his will on the people. He simply stated, "I vote for the Islamic Republic." He did not say that others should vote for it as well. The people were free to cast a negative vote in a referendum, but instead, over 98% of them voted positively. Under the previous regime, the Shah had told the people that if anyone did not join the Rastakhiz party, they would have to leave the country, which made people join it out of fear. However, this was not the case with the 1979 referendum. Imam Khomeini's character was not one to force people into anything against their will.
Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, several parties and groups in the country's border cities sought to raise issues of autonomy and the potential secession of certain provinces, aiming to exploit the atmosphere created by the collapse of the previous regime. They attempted to persuade the revolution's leaders to accept their demands for autonomy prior to the referendum. However, Imam Khomeini regarded the integrity of Iran's territory as non-negotiable. In response, these groups announced their decision to abstain from participating in the elections as a form of protest and retaliation. Documents retrieved from the U.S. Embassy after its takeover on November 4, 1979, revealed that the embassy had been closely monitoring discussions regarding the referendum for the future government since February 4, 1979. One such document highlighted the public support for Imam Khomeini, noting, "At least 13 groups or individuals are contending for power. Currently, a significant portion of power resides with the devoted religious followers of Imam Khomeini. If a referendum occurs in March, it is almost certain that Imam Khomeini's Islamic Republic will prevail." The key aspect of the Iranian Islamic Republic referendum was the freedom afforded to the people in their electoral participation. There was no coercion or pressure. Citizens participated voluntarily, exercising their right to express their opinions. Imam Khomeini repeatedly underscored that voting in the referendum was entirely voluntary, encouraging individuals to cast their ballots freely.
In Islamic teachings, the concepts of the masses and people hold great significance and are frequently discussed in the Holy Quran. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, never attempted to establish an Islamic government under the people demanded that he become their leader. Therefore, there is no contradiction between republicanism and Islamism. An Islamic government is established when the people desire such a government. Regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran, the important point is that the majority of the people are themselves Muslims, and their demand is naturally for the implementation of Islamic laws. When the people voted for the Islamic Republic in the 1979 referendum, they were fully aware of what they were voting for. They all wanted Islam to be implemented in society. It was precisely for this reason that they allowed Imam Khomeini, a religious scholar, to lead their revolution. Essentially, their opposition to the Shah stemmed from the Shah's opposition to Islamic laws. In other words, the people were seeking Islam because they saw freedom, social participation, and their rights within it. They saw all their desires fulfilled in Islam.
Mehdi Bazargan, the Prime Minister of the Provisional Government, addressed concerns surrounding the legitimacy of the election years later, when he was already fallen from favor. This election was conducted entirely freely and voluntarily, with neither the provisional government nor any influential figures or organizations issuing threats. The imam did not impose any religious obligations nor issue fatwas. Instead, individuals went to the polls of their own volition and cast their affirmative votes into the ballot boxes.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
In his message commemorating this significant day, Imam Khomeini declared, "Today is the first day of the rule of Allah. Our nation should celebrate this day." He emphasized, "God has granted us the strength to dismantle the regime of arrogance. Our great nation stands as a leader for the oppressed nations of the world." He affirmed that in this new government, distinctions of race, whether black or white, Turk, Kurd, Baluch, or Persian, are irrelevant. All are treated equally, and there are no differences between men and women or among religious minorities when it comes to justice. The 98.2% approval vote for the establishment of the Islamic Republic stands out as one of the most notable aspects of this historic referendum. This overwhelming consensus is a unique hallmark in history for the Islamic Republic, as no other revolution or referendum has ever recorded such a high level of support. Some Western analysts anticipated that at best only 60% of the population would favor the Islamic Republic, with a substantial 40% likely to express strong opposition. Others even speculated that the public might reject the concept of an Islamic Republic altogether. However, the 98.2% endorsement from the public astonished the world, showcasing the significant support for the Islamic Revolution.
After the referendum and the announcement of the results, Imam Khomeini said, "Today is the first day of God's governance on earth. This is a very important point. After the early Islamic period, no government was established based on Islamic rules on earth. Power rested in the hands of monarchs who ruled through the sword and whose governance was not rooted in religion or Islamic laws. After centuries, a religious government was formed in Iran through the choice of the people. This was a significant spiritual resurrection in the 20th century. As we know, in the second half of the 20th century, there was conflict between liberalism and Marxism, two completely secular discourses. The events following the Islamic Revolution vividly illustrated the impact of this religious revolution on the region and the world, especially in reviving religious thought. Many thinkers have discussed and written about this topic. At that time, two French journalists published a book titled Iran, Revolution in the Name of God. Revolutions, particularly in the 20th century, generally had a Marxist and anti-religious nature, making the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which had a religious essence, entirely unique. This is why Imam Khomeini declared such a remarkable day as a celebration and referred to it as Yom Allah, or the Day of God.
A defining characteristic of the Islamic Revolution that set it apart from other global revolutions was the prompt organization of a referendum to determine the form of government less than 2 months after the revolution's triumph. To ensure transparency of the referendum process, the provisional government invited a delegation from the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, comprised of one woman and three men, to Iran. Their role was to observe and document the historical events surrounding the referendum.
The revolutionary society accepted the question posed in the referendum, the Islamic Republic, yes or no. Some may now ask why no other questions were asked, but at that time, the people had no objections to this question, indicating that they themselves wanted this type of political system. The overwhelming 98% approval also supports this claim. It appears that the people were well aware of the nature of the Islamic Republic, and there was no debate about whether the priority was on republicanism or Islamism. They did not see these two as separate, but rather considered them as a unified concept. In practice, in the decades following the revolution, efforts were made to ensure that the will of the people guides policy making. Another important point is that the establishment of the Expediency Council was fundamentally created to find suitable solutions in case of conflicts between Republic and Islam. For instance, when the parliament representing the people passes a law that the Guardian Council deems contrary to Islamic laws, the Expediency Council intervenes to resolve the issue, prioritizing the will of the people in this process.
The ultimate aim of the Iranian people in their long-fought revolution was to establish the Islamic Republic. The term republic, meaning masses, illustrates the people's central role in post-1979 era, and it reflects the importance of their voice in shaping their own destinies. The word Islamic sets apart this republic from others, underscoring the dominance of divine and Quranic values in the governance of the nation.
On October 14, 1978, during an interview with a French newspaper, Le Figaro, the reporter asked Imam Khomeini this question: "What direction does your movement take, and what kind of regime do you want to replace the Shah's regime?" The Imam responded, "Naturally, one can consider an Islamic Republic." In the subsequent days and weeks, as he encountered a barrage of inquiries from foreign journalists, Ayatollah Khomeini further clarified this concept, stating, "We seek an Islamic Republic. The term republic defines the form and structure of governance, while Islamic refers to the content of that governance, which is based on divine laws." Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution and prior to the referendum, Muslim scholars made concerted efforts to explain the concept of an Islamic Republic to the public. Their aim was to ensure that citizens could participate in the referendum with clear understanding, thereby allowing their votes to authentically represent their will. For example, martyr Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari described the term Islamic Republic in this way. The notion of a republic pertains to the form of governance, which grants the people the right to shape their own destiny. The term Islamic delineates the content of this governance. Thus, an Islamic Republic signifies a government in which the leadership is elected by the people and the governance is grounded in Islamic principles and laws. Mr. Taraqi noted that the idea of a republic, often used in Western discourse, conveys a different meaning in the context of Islam.
The concept of republic in Islam is somewhat different. When we talk about republic in Islam, we are not just referring to people's participation in elections. Rather, it encompasses much more. The role of the people in determining their own destiny must be significant and meaningful in culture, economics, and governance. That's why Article 8 of the Constitution mentions public oversight, meaning the people have the authority to oversee the actions of officials in the country. The people have the power to question any official who acts improperly and, if necessary, remove them. Similarly, in the economy, conditions must be created for public participation rather than everything being under government control. The same applies to cultural activities, where the people should play a central role. This is the concept of republic within an Islamic framework, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has considered all of these aspects and established laws accordingly.
Today, 46 years after this monumental collective decision, the resilient and revolutionary people of Iran continue to stand strong. Despite external pressures and aggressive sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies, they remain committed to the system born from the blood of martyrs. They walk forward with hope on this shining path, a path that, while challenging, will ultimately lead to the pinnacle of happiness and perfection, inshallah.
The 98.2% vote in favor of the Islamic Republic was a thorn in the side of world powers, especially the United States, that had lost all its interests in the country. In reaction, these powers attempted to stir unrest within Iran, aiming to undermine this national achievement and facilitate the fragmentation of the Islamic Republic. The U.S. orchestrated a series of conspiracies, starting in Kurdistan, Gombad, and Khuzestan, which continued until the outbreak of the war imposed by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Yet, under the leadership of Imam Khomeini and the unwavering determination of the Iranian people, these schemes ultimately faltered. The people renewed their commitment to the Islamic Republic through countless declarations of support and fresh pledges, resiliently pursuing their sacred goal of establishing a system rooted in the will of the people and divine principles. The official establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran on April 1st also rekindled hope among oppressed nations worldwide. Disillusioned with Western models, these nations recognized that, with steadfast religious conviction and a national will similar to that of the Iranian people, they too could overcome their challenges and create governments that genuinely reflect their aspirations, fully aligned with divine guidance. We also asked Mr. Akhavan a challenging question. Why doesn't the Islamic Republic of Iran conduct another referendum similar to the one in 1979 to assess whether people still support the current system? This question often arises in foreign media during protests in the country. Here is his response.
No political system in the world puts its survival up for a vote. Such a thing simply does not exist. Why? There is a rational reason for this. If a political system were to put its survival to a vote, the sovereignty of the country would be at risk, and the nation would descend into chaos. Imagine you need to make an economic decision based on the country's laws. If you know that these laws will soon lose their validity and another government will establish new laws, you would be unable to make a decision. This is why no government in the world puts its existence to a new vote.
The reasoning is not purely political, but rather social. Governments exist to bring order to affairs, and it would be contrary to order to set a time limit or expiration date for a government. If a government had a definite term and an expiration date, it would lack authority, which goes against rational thought. This is a human experience. Even in liberal systems that claim to uphold democracy, you have never seen them state, "We will be in power until a certain date, after which we will hold a referendum to see if the people want us or not." In countries where referendums are frequently held, they're never about the continuity of the government, but rather about significant decisions. The essence of governments is that they are unchanging, and this is a human experience that we also rely on. If some believe that the Islamic Republic must hold a referendum to ensure its existence, they should propose a model, one that the entire world would accept. Is such a model in existence?
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again same times next week to see what else is on. Until next time, take care.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasir, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. One of the, if you like to call it, key beliefs in Islam is the belief in tawassul. However, there have been certain elements within Islam and the Islamic history that have oppose and criticize this Islamic belief, and I say that purposefully, that it is an Islamic belief. It is not a belief just for the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. No, all Muslims believe in this concept of tawassul. It is a concept that is clearly expressed within the Quran al-Majid, within the ahadith of the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and many other things. So this particular book, which is called Tawassul Demystified, aims to answer certain particular questions in a lesson manner regarding what tawassul is, you know, is it permissible, where it can be found, and so on and so forth. This book that we will introduce in our next segment is titled Tawassul Demystified. Please join us in our next segment. We will delve a bit deeper into this book, inshallah.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. So as mentioned previously, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners was titled Tawassul Demystified. This book was written by Sheikh Hussein Akhund Ali and translated by Brother Ali Mansouri. It was published by the Naba Cultural Organization, which is located in Tehran in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this book contains seven lessons around the concept of tawassul. And as I mentioned in our previous segment, that the concept of tawassul is not something that is outside of Islam. It is not something that has been taken from another religion or another cult or something that was just made up by certain Muslims. No. It is something important. It is a human natural need by which a person seeks the help of somebody who is superior to them in trying to attain something. However, it is important here to understand that the concept of tawassul in its reality is not something that is discussed in this book. What is discussed in this book is the permissibility of tawassul, the history of tawassul, where we see tawassul in, for example, the Quran al-Majid and in certain supplications. For example, right? We have lesson one, it explains what is tawassul, the lexical meaning of wasila and tawassul. Wasila is the means by which a person seeks tawassul through. Tawassul from a rational perspective, characteristics of things we make tawassul to, or rather those things that tawassul can be made to. For example, can you make tawassul through a glass of water, for example? You know, obviously there's a discussion. Then we have lesson two, tawassul, an exemplification of worshipping God, the obligation to tawassul, examples of wasila. Then you have lesson three of examples of tawassul in the Quran al-Majid. Then lesson four, tawassul in Shi'i and Sunni narrations. For example, in narrations, we have plenty in the Shia corpus of hadith. But it's not to say that our Sunni brothers and sisters don't have plenty. They have plenty of traditions regarding tawassul and the legitimacy and the authenticity and the legality of it. Then we have lesson five, tawassul in supplications and ziyarah, and when we go and visit the imam or a very divine saint of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when we read this particular visitation or the ziyarah, there are certain places within it that clearly identify and allude to, or rather indicate, tawassul. Lesson six, also answering some questions. And this is an important point. So as we see, the reality of tawassul is not mentioned, but the discussion of examples of it, where it is done, is mentioned. For example, question one, why do we seek tawassul? Is tawassul a form of shirk? For example, these are questions that many of us may have been asked. For example, question five, if we say Ya Ali, Ya Hussein, or Ya Mahdi, have we become mushriks? Again, going back to question two. Question seven, do the graves of the imams have a special significance? Do these locations have an impact on whether supplications are accepted? So these are important questions. Why go to ziyarah? Is it necessary to go to ziyarah? Do we have to go to Karbala or to Mashhad or to Najaf or to Jannatul Baqi, for example, to do the ziyarah? Can we do it from home? What is the difference, for example? These are some of the questions. And then there's the last question, just to mention it. How can inanimate objects and the dead, which lack any sort of effect on the external world, have the capability to heal us? Means it to affect things in the material world. For example, one of the things we seek intercession with is the Hajj al-Aswad. You know, what is the purpose of it? Can we do it? Can we not do it? What is the legitimacy behind it? And so on and so forth. So these are some of the questions that are posed in this particular text. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion of this text for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners in this program was titled Tawassul Demystified. It was written by Sheikh Hussein Akhund Ali and translated by Brother Ali Mansouri and published by the Naba Cultural Organization. So we were reading from the first lesson, what is Tawassul? In the current lesson, we will examine the lexical and colloquial meaning of Tawassul. Colloquial here is an incorrect translation. Yeah, it doesn't mean colloquial. It means the terminological meaning, the parlance of tawassul in the Islamic tradition. What does tawassul mean in the Islamic tradition? When we say tawassul, what do we mean? Colloquial is a completely incorrect translation. Then we will examine tawassul from a rational perspective. Finally, we will discuss the individuals and beings that can make tawassul, that we can make tawassul to. The lexical meaning of wasila and tawassul. The word wasila comes from the Arabic root wasala, which is defined as wasala means rank, wasila means closeness. Rank means having a high position. Thus, the root of wasila relates to having a position or being close to something. This is why any means through which one can get close to another thing is called a wasila. The word wasila is not just limited to objects, but can also refer to deeds. Tawassul to someone through a wasila means getting close to them through a deed. In short, a wasila is an object or deed through which one can get close to a thing or person. The act of doing this is called tawassul. In the current work, our focus will be on tawassul to the 14 infallibles to get close to God or to reach a specific goal. Tawassul from a rational perspective. Throughout the course of our daily routines, we frequently make use of wasilas without even realizing it. For example, our means for traveling for over long distances is making use of various vehicles and examples of different means throughout our daily lives. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the ability to truly be interceded for by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. As we said, the reality of tawassul is not spoken about in this particular work. But what is important is that we have to have the capacity within ourselves to have that wasila impact our lives. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to get that capacity, that dharfiyah, so that we are under the guise of the tawassul of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. InshaAllah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasir, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
death toll from the genocidal war on Gaza rises above 50,600 as the Israeli military carries out more attacks on the Palestinian territory. Hamas military wing says Israeli assassinations won't stop the resistance as an airstrike by the regime's military on Lebanon kills a Hamas commander. And finally, two Palestinians have been killed in separate Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Israel's air and artillery strikes continue to kill more Palestinians in Gaza as the regime's all-out war rages on across the besieged strip. At least 25 people have